It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Pete Tridish. Pete Tridish is with the Prometheus Radio Project, and he is in town for this weekend's Northwest Community Radio Summit. Pete, thanks for coming in and talking with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me here.
If you would begin, tell us a bit about the Prometheus Radio Project and how you got involved in it.
Sure. Prometheus Radio Project started back in about 1998. I had been a radio pirate for a couple years prior to that. We were a small group of people. None of us had ever been on the radio. None of us ever knew anything about radio, but we were activists in different social movements, either housing or environment, or a lot of friends were involved in AIDS prevention and AIDS AIDS education. And just what we found over and over again was that we were able to raise issues. You know, we go out and hold signs and lock ourselves to things and all that sort of thing. But once it got to the news, it would always end up being that you know, we were on for 2 seconds with a sign that said, "Don't do that." And then our opponents would be, you know, then they would get on the next night on the Lair News Hour, and they would, you know, be there for 15 minutes in the jacket and tie and saying why we were idiots and we didn't know what we were talking about. And, you know, they really had everything quite taken care of. And we were just sort of tired of that kind of imbalance. And so we started a pirate radio station. We called it Radio Mutiny, and it took us about 9 months or so. And then, you know, we certainly blew up a couple of transmitters in the middle of trying to learn how to make them. But finally, we got ourselves on the air, and we broadcast with about 20 watts for a period of about a year and a half or so until we were finally shut down. And it was an incredible project because, you know, we started with just a handful of people, but within a few months of actually learning how to make the transmitter go, we had 80 programmers that were on, you know, 7 nights a week and coming from like all different groups and kinds of ideas. And so that experience sort of taught me that every community has lots of people who want to be involved in a participatory radio and people that have all sorts of things to say that, you know, just wouldn't make it if you just left it to the corporations, what the important parts of American ideas and culture are. And so we started Prometheus after my pirate radio station got confiscated by the FCC. And the very same week, there was an interesting shift in the FCC because the chairman of the FCC at the time said, "Well, I'm going to go out and confiscate all these pirate radio stations. But I'm starting to see that some of these radio pirates are not, you know, just in it for breaking the law, that what they really want to do is have radio stations and communicate." And so what William Kennard at the time did was he opened up a rulemaking and said, you know, if it is possible, we're going to change the rules in such a way that these small pirate radio stations should be able to, you know, have a voice. And so I started Prometheus Radio Project with a few other people on the rather absurd premise that while everyone else was having fun continuing to start up new pirate radio stations, we were going to be stuck with the kind of, you know, the crap work of going to Washington and, you know, and wrestling with the bureaucrats for a few years. But as it turned out, he was for real. He got very serious about low power radio, and in 2000 we had a new, you know, the rules were changed, and it opened up a lot more opportunities for low power radio around the United States. And so ever since then, we've been sort of trying to make the very best of the low power radio service, make it, there are a lot of ways it wasn't what we were hoping for, but what we do is we help small civil rights groups, environmental groups, farm workers organizations, just musicians that want to start radio stations. And we help them with, you know, some technical support. We help organize politically to make sure that the stations are treated more fairly. And so that's kind of what we do.
And you were just involved in a recent barn raising down in Oregon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. The group is Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos del Noreste. It's a farm workers labor union in Woodburn, Oregon, and they applied about 5 years ago for their radio license, and it just came out of the commission maybe a year and a half back. And so we worked with them to build the radio station over the course of the weekend. We have these events that we call radio barn raisings, and a radio barn raising is where we call on all of our friends, all the radio producers, engineers, volunteers, all different sorts of people, and we pull them together for a weekend, and we build the entire radio station from out of the boxes of equipment, and by 5 o'clock on Sunday, or sometimes 6 o'clock on Sunday, we flip the switch and we turn it on, and then as everyone's driving away, they get to hear it on the air for the first time and get a sense of the signal, and they're also kind of these just sort of defining moments where we're all together and we talk a lot about what the future of low power radio is going to be, and community radio, participatory radio. And we also have about 40 workshops, usually how to conduct an interview, how to wire a mixing board, how to tune an antenna, how to fundraise for a radio station. And so that's kind of the context in which we sort of build the movement to get better treatment for low power radio stations.
And can you give us a sense overall of how low power FM is doing nationally? Because, back in 2000, I remember that was so inspiring that finally opened up.
Yeah, it was a great moment in January when the engineers and the policymakers at the FCC decided in favor of low power radio. And, it was one of those moments you're like, oh, wait, we do live in some form of a democracy. but then the reality of the situation clunked us on the head about 8 months later, which was that even though we had successfully persuaded the FCC, Congress came back at the prodding of National Public Radio and the National Association of Broadcasters and took away about three-quarters of the licenses we would have gotten, and basically all of the licenses in the major urban areas. They did this on the pretense that our little 100-watt radio stations were going to interfere with their 40,000 and 50,000-watt radio stations. And so ever since then, a law has been in effect. It was called the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act, which prevents the FCC from distributing these licenses basically in any of the top 50 markets. I could go into a whole engineering discussion of exactly how they managed to implement that, but basically the effect was, under the FCC's rules, and what the FCC's engineers found was that there were room for about 25 new stations in the top 10 urban markets. And most small towns had 4 or 5 channels that were usable for these 100-watt radios. Under Congress's rules, and the reality of it right now, is that none of the top 50 markets got any radio stations, and most small towns ended up with maybe one channel, or if they were really lucky, maybe two channels. And so what happened was, a lot of these towns, well, first of all, most groups were just shut totally out. And then the ones that were left, there ended up being 4 or 5 different organizations that had applied for radio licenses, and they all had to share this channel or compete. And so you might have, the Church of the Lord's Mighty Sword has, one application in, and the, Infernal, Drumming Brigade has another application in, and all these people have to, figure out how to share this one time slot, And, it was just kind of a, you know, it was kind of a mess. And so it took the FCC a long time to sort of sort out who would end up with these last, you know, a couple precious licenses. We do have a bill in Congress right now that is endorsed by one of your senators, is actually one of the co-sponsors, Maria Cantwell, which her and John McCain and Patrick Leahy have introduced a bill to get rid of the congressional restrictions and go back to the FCC standards. And so that's real exciting. And your senator, Maria Cantwell, is, she has one of the only engineers that I've met in Congress, and it's really great. Her staff person, Michael Dom, has been fantastic in actually like looking at the issue and being like, wait a second, Congress passed what kind of law? And he, you know, just sort of looked out over the engineering of it, and he was just sort of shocked that, you know, such a sort of a flimsy sort of reasoned bill could have passed. And so they've been really great on fighting this with us.
So if that passed, or they nixed the previous legislation, that would open up what, roughly four new frequencies in each municipality?
You know, depending on where it is. The way it works is that it just depends on how many radio stations are already there. And so some places it would be three, some places it would be six. It all just sort of depends on how close you are to a major urban area and so on. There would probably still be a few places where there just aren't any channels, and I would think of maybe New York and LA. Those radio dials truly are very closed up, and there's not a lot of more opportunities there. But there are a lot more opportunities than the National Association of Broadcasters would like you to think.
All right. And beyond low-power FM, what other opportunities are on the horizon here?
Well, there is kind of an interesting opportunity coming up, which is that for the first time in 20 years, the FCC is opening up a full-power radio licensing window. And the weird thing is that the FCC isn't on any kind of a schedule. Basically, the opportunities for radio licensing, low power, full power, they basically come when, I don't know, Neptune is aligned with Venus and Andromeda or whatever. You know, it's just like there's no schedule. Even George Bush doesn't know when they're going to open up the full power radio window. But we have received some word that sometime in the next year or so, for the first time in 20 years, they're going to open that up. Now, the thing about the full power radio licensing is it's much more powerful than the low powers. Low powers are only up to 100 watts. Full powers are as many watts as fit. So you could have a 10,000 or a 50,000 watt station. The problem is that they're only available in, again, very small towns, areas where there's a lot more cows than people usually. And so we're spending a lot of time this year, but because it's been 20 years since they've opened it up, there are a fair number of areas that have grown over that time. And so there are some interesting opportunities. There are some towns up to as big as, say, the size of, say, Spokane or you know, sort of medium-sized towns, the 50th and 75th and 100th biggest markets, not the top 50, but some of those places that really need radio. And I do have to say that, you know, I'm from Brooklyn originally. I live in Philadelphia. I'm kind of a big city sort of a person. But if there's one good thing that's happened for me personally in all this is I've spent a lot more time in small towns over the course of the past couple of years, and because that's where we've been able to build radio stations. And you know, there are a lot of myths about small town America that I think just don't really stand up. You know, people think of them as not very diverse and close-minded. And the truth of the matter is, almost every place I go, I find people that want to start radio stations that are progressive-minded, that are, you know, diverse. There are enormous populations of immigrant farm worker laborers and all that sort of thing in these small towns. But the problem is, that they have no voice. There aren't institutions of community media. There aren't radio stations and access channels and like and all those sorts of things. So you would just never know that they were there. And so it's been very exciting for me to spend a lot of time in a lot of red states. You know, a lot of places where you think that you're just not going to meet anyone interesting or anything. And you go, and every place you go, there are these amazing people that, you know, they don't want to, you know, move away from Iowa and move to the Bay Area and be just another, you know, just another liberal or something like that. They, you know, they want to make a difference in their town. They want to, you know, expand the culture there. And they just end up, you know, and so one of the things that they're really holding on to is, oh, I applied for this radio station 4 years ago, and maybe the FCC is going to give me a permit one day. So that's been really exciting work for us to start looking at why it is that our culture, you know, gets you know, accumulates in the big cities, and then you're just left with all these places out in the Midwest or whatever where. People write books like "What's the Matter with Kansas?" and that sort of thing. Well, actually, there are a lot of great people there. It's just that you can't see them; they're invisible.
And are you hopeful? Do you feel that the groundwork is being laid to what the media likes to call leveling the playing field in terms of when these new licenses become available, both at the low power FM? Should that legislation be successful, and then with the higher power, full power? FM coming up, that communities will have the tools they need to be able to take on the corporations, which I have to imagine are salivating over these potential licenses?
Well, in these particular cases, they're both non-commercial licenses. And so mostly what the corporations want is that they just don't go on the air at all. With the full power, there's less they can do about it. It's pretty well established in law. With the low power, they can still oppose our changes that would open up the airwaves further. So at least with full power, we know it's going to happen. We just don't know when. But with low power would make a lot more impact because it would actually be something that could reach the cities. And as much as I just said I liked working in small towns, I still do really want... I know so many people around the country after 9 or 10 years of doing this that have been waiting. They've been, you know, they've been sort of stashing their pennies and they're like, you know, one of these days we're gonna have a radio station. And so I really want to, you know, we're hoping to win in Congress. I don't know if we'll win in this Congress or in a future Congress, but I think at some point there is no real rational basis for the rule that stands right now, and I think we will be able to take it off as soon as we get some decision makers that are willing to look at it.
Well, you've mentioned the FCC multiple times, and obviously they play a key role in all this, and just this week I understand news came out that the former chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, had a report about problems with, or not problems, but corporations and big media and the way that they cover news versus local news. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a real tough one. The FCC back in 2003 under Michael Powell made a decision that they wanted to allow drastic media consolidation. They wanted, they would have changed the rules in such a way. Let me back up, because most people don't even necessarily realize this. That we do have a set of rules right now that says that if you're the owner of a big newspaper, you cannot own in the same town the television station. And if you own the television station, you can't own the radio stations in town. And those rules were just put in place because, you know, some people back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, they were like, well, that sounds like it would be a really bad idea to have one person owning, you know, all the media in a town. And so they put these very sensible rules in place that just prevent massive media power from accumulating in the hands of just, you know, one or two people or companies or whatever in a given city. And there was this move among industry. One thing that's important to understand about the media industry is that there's a really, economically, there's a great deal of incentive not to make local content, but rather to have, to have a corporation make content once and then put it over 1,000 radio stations. And it's cheaper because you end up making the content once. If you're like a mom and pop radio station, you make your content once and you play it and you get one ad revenue. But if you're Clear Channel, you make your content once, you put over 1,200 radio stations, you get 1,200 ad revenues for the production. And so what you lose in that is basically the thing that radio is supposed to do for us the most, which is have the local sense. And so many things, so many of us know more about the war in the Middle East than we know about the local zoning dispute or the issues at the local hospital or the education system. And the problem with this is that the local level is where we can have the most impact as citizens in a democracy. And the local level is where, you know, on a cultural level, I mean, so many more people know Britney Spears or something than know a local band that, you know, just can't get on the radio because the programming decisions are made in San Antonio. And so there's this sort of dramatic failure there. Well, anyway, the FCC made this decision, and under this decision, they knocked away all the rules that preserved the local elements of radio, TV, newspapers. And in so doing, they created a situation where you could be the owner of like two or three television stations, eight radio stations, the newspaper, the cable franchise, the satellite network. You could even own the nuclear power plant down the road, and there would be nothing wrong with that. And so we actually went to court and we sued them over this, and we actually managed to get a stay on the implementation of these rules, and the judges told the FCC to go back and like rethink these a little bit because they just really they didn't make sense. They hadn't rationally justified it. Throughout this whole thing, the chairman of the FCC had said, "Well, you know, I know that 3 million Americans have commented against our changes in the rules. But, you know, all these groups like Prometheus and all these others that, you know, they've all been fear-mongering and trying to frighten people with these big media bogeymen. But we're only using empirical evidence and we're using science and, using important studies that are done by economists because we're not going to make these decisions based on just a lot of rumors and insinuations." And so now it comes out 2 years later that he had commissioned a report to see whether local TV stations that had local owners produced more local news. The report was done. There was a giant sample, 4,000 radio TV shows over the course of a couple year or two, and it was a pretty incredible report that was done by two of the FCC's economists. And unfortunately for the chairman, the results came out that locally owned TV stations do produce more local news, about five more minutes per half hour newscast, so a significant portion. And when the results came in, Chairman Powell said, "I don't like that report. Let's destroy it." And basically, this report was shredded and never saw the light of day. And so, as it turns out, when it didn't conform to his policy objectives, he had no interest in the empirical evidence that even his own economists had generated. And so we think about all the comments that we generated and the stuff that we put in, over that time. And it's just really disappointing, you know, because my job as an activist is to tell people that what you're doing makes a difference, that even though, you know, it doesn't always go your way, that there's a chance that the people that are going to look at this stuff when you speak up as a citizen are going to look at it, and maybe it'll make a difference. And so this kind of an incident, just, I almost don't like to talk about it, because it just increases everybody's cynicism that you're just going to, you know, put yourself into something and try to talk to you know, a government agency about something. And, you know, if you make a good argument, you know what you're talking about, maybe they're going to listen. And it's just sad that there's so many cases where that's just not really the case. Low power radio is a good example of when that actually worked. And so, you know, I try not to, you know, make everyone hopeless about that, because actually people do win change, and that's really important. But this is just a case where you just realize how stacked the deck is against you, and just gives you a little pause.
And yet, if you look at the turnout for when they were proposing the recent changes, and when the FCC was sending its members around to different towns in the U.S. to hear from the public, that the response from the public was overwhelming, that the people would pack the halls where they would show up, that the people that would oppose the consolidation of the media were on both sides, you know, both right and left, didn't matter. People were passionate about this. So that in itself has always been inspiring, I thought.
Yeah. There's been an incredible process of a lot of people coming out and talking about these ownership rules, learning about their existence and talking. And a lot of low power stations have come out to these too. And one thing that we really like about the low power stations is that they kind of become focuses for people that are thinking about the role of media in the democracy. And one thing that's happening that's not too far from here, in Spokane, there's a great low power radio station that is being threatened by being taken off the air, and a lot of low power stations in this situation have sort of testified at these hearings. It's in Spokane, Washington. And one of the worst things that happened in the low power rules was that the FCC said, okay, yeah, you can have the low power radio stations, but if a full power station ever wanted your channel for some reason, they could really just sort of come in and they can take it, because you're a secondary service and the full power stations are primary services. And because they're bigger, they obviously must be doing something more important and better. And the situation couldn't be more stark in this case. You have like sort of this small low power station that has over 100 volunteers and has all kinds of different shows and does all kinds of public affairs programming. And it's one that we actually worked with to start in a barn raising a couple of years ago. And on the other side, there's this full power station in Sandpoint, Idaho, that wanted to expand its signal and reach over into Spokane. And they saw that, you know, this low power station had this sort of nice signal there. And they just said, oh, well, they're just a secondary station, so we can just take their channel. And so right now, the people in Spokane are kind of fighting on this issue. And it's one of the key things that we want the FCC to change, is to really, like, rethink, what's this second-class citizen business? I mean, you know, if you're a radio station, you're a radio station. And it just seems crazy to give people a license, and then 2 years later, when just, like, someone bigger comes along and says, oh, I want that, then you just, you know, give it over to them. So that's one of the ways that we're working with low power stations to change the rules and just, you know, make things a little bit more fair all around.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Oh, thanks so much. Great to be on here.
Just been talking with Pete Tridish. He is with the Prometheus Radio Project, and you can find out more about them at their website, prometheusradio.org. There's also the Northwest Community Radio Summit that's happening today. Actually, it's started this morning at 8, happening up at the Capitol Hill Arts Center, and then Amy Goodman speaking tonight at Town Hall at 7 p.m., so plenty to do.